What up? I'm Toby Windham, and I'm an actor and a producer, and I'm pushing a blue minivan. This ride is all about the process of the journey, the who, what's, and the whys that have allowed you to get from point A to point B. We gonna ride, we gonna laugh, and we about to be crazy. There's gonna be some knowledge drops, so you better grab them as they fall out. This ride is for the community. I'm picking up all my friends, and we're chatting about the joys, the battles, the fly moments, and the speed bumps on the road to success. So hey, welcome to the blue minivan. Let's ride. Let's ride. Let's ride. What up, y'all? It's Toby, and we up in the blue minivan with the homie, the friend, the Oscar winner, Kemp Powers. What up, bro?
How's it going?
I'm chilling, man. I'm chilling. Before I jump into just talking to you, I want to let everybody know everything that I know you've done, because I know we're going to get into stuff you like, yo, I've also did this. But Kemp is a writer, and just to be more like, just to get down to all the specificity of what that means, playwright, screenwriter, a director, animation writer. Stop me whenever I need to, man, because I know you do it all. Probably a poet. Like, you probably got all of that stuff up under you.
No, actually, I do not mess with poetry. I'll admit. Okay. I can enjoy poetry, but I don't write it.
All right.
I learned early on that that is not a strong suit.
I know everyone in the world saw Soul. He got an Oscar for that. One Night in Miami. I also know that a whole bunch of people saw that. I am such a fan of Little Black Shadows, which I got to see. Also, Crystal McCullough, Eyes Were Blue. And you're pinning and directing this new Spider-Man, or just directing?
Just directing this one.
Okay. Let's just get into everything, man. Well, like, what's up? Like, I'm sure your life is a whirlwind right now. No?
Yes and no. I mean, time has been, there's nothing more valuable to me than my time. The reality is, that's been the case for several years now, even before, you know, this past year, because the reality is with Pixar movies, you know, it's a long, you know, very hardworking process to create one of those films. And it takes several years. And the journey of getting One Night in Miami made as a film, that was another like 6-7 year journey. Mm. So, you know, I've been working overtime for so many years. Like, it's so funny. You're catching me. Like, we're squeezing in this conversation because tomorrow I'm flying out to New York, and I took a week off, and it's the first week I've had off of work, and I'm not kidding you. I think it might be close to 5 years. Mm. You know, like, I'm not joking. I have not had more than a day or two off, usually because I'm sick or something like that, in close to 5 years now. Vacations haven't factored in. Like, there's just been no time for anything. So the only thing that's really changed since this the award season is just that a lot more people are interested in my work. But the stuff that I'm working on right now, I mean, a lot of that stuff is stuff that I started on before Soul or One Night in Miami even came out. Mm. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, like, I jumped on board Spider-Verse as soon as we wrapped on Soul. Mm-hmm. So I've been working on Spider-Verse for over a year now. You know what I mean? Like, this doesn't feel like it's new news to people out there, but you know, it's been a full-time gig for quite a while. And I've also gotten, you know, a couple of screenplays written during that time that I had to work on. So, yeah, man, it's honestly just managing my time better, trying to figure out a way to manage my time in a way so that I actually get a little bit of time off. And I'm not trying to whine or complain. There's just so many projects out there, so many ideas I have that I'm so excited about. I want to do them all.
Yeah.
And there's just not enough time in the day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's just, I'm in my late 40s, man. Like, I don't have all day. You know, and
man, what you touched on is, because I met you probably like five or six years ago, maybe less than that. And I knew how hard you were working then. And I like it so fits into where you are now, because when I met you, man, like, we were at the Denver Center. And one thing that I picked up from you is that you were really good at communication. Like, aside from writing, I was like, the way that you were able to use language in the room where we were working on this new play, and usually, like, we work on a new play and it just be 1 week. We had like time together.
Yeah, we had a few weeks.
where does that come in your process? Like, how did you become just good at communication?
Honestly, I mean, I've always described what I am to people. It was really a nice introduction you gave me. How I've always described myself to other people is simply as a storyteller. That's what I describe myself as. I don't describe myself as a screenwriter, as a director, as a playwright. I'm a storyteller, and the mediums change. And part of being a storyteller is that, like, you know, you're a good listener. Mm-hmm. And I like the communal vibe of sharing stories, listening to other people's stories, and then engaging them with stories of my own. And I guess I just apply that to my communication with people in general. That's something that I've always done. I really credit a lot of it, man, to my previous career. I was a journalist for almost 2 decades.
Okay.
So, you know, to be a good reporter and writer, you have to be a good listener. You have to take incredibly good notes. You have to shut up and open yourself up and really listen to what people are telling you, and also get really good at reading between the lines. So you develop really strong, I think, interpersonal skills from being in that business. And considering that was the career that I thought was going to be my only career, I think the fact that I moved into the creative arts, those journalism, those reporting, those listening skills have really served me well in the collaborative process. Because so much of this, whether it be plays or movies or animated movies, it's all about collaboration. And I think that my skill set really lends itself well to the collaborative process.
How did you make the move into the creative process from journalism? Did it pick you? Did something happen where it was like, this is my route now?
It was really organic, man. It wasn't a plan. It's like, I guess if you do anything long enough for fun, you might wake up one day and realize you've gotten pretty good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of my transition into theater and screenwriting, it's kind of like that thing I was doing as a hobby on nights and weekends for years and years and years. And at a certain point, enough people had gotten interested in my writing that there was a question of like, so, you know, do you have anything that you'd actually like to see produced? And coincidentally, when my first play, which was One Night in Miami, was produced here in Los Angeles in 2013, that coincided with me pretty much losing my last journalism job, because, you know, journalism has been contracting as an industry for many, many years. So I never thought that, like, when I got laid off from my last full-time journalism job, that would be the end of my journalism career, that my creative writing career was going to get such legs that I would be able to do exclusively that. But, you know, I got laid off, and I kind of found myself in this weird situation where it was a pretty good job. I had stock vested, so I had enough money in the bank to kind of cover my salary for about 2 years. So what normally happens in a situation like that is you're like, okay, find yourself another journalism job as soon as you possibly can, because, you know, you don't want to spend that money that's saved up. But this time I kind of was at a crossroads, and I was like, you know what, dude, you're 40 years old now. You've been doing this thing for fun for so many years. When are you going to really bet on yourself? And I decided to make that the time. My play had come out. It was getting pretty well received. There was a lot of interest in me as a writer. So I gave myself, I said, okay, I have 2 years salary. I'm going to give myself 2 years. You know, I'm going to live off of what I have in the bank, and I'm going to devote myself 100% of my time and energy to making my creative writing career stick. And if it doesn't pan out in the next 2 years, I'm going to walk away. And I can't complain. I can't say I didn't give it the old college try, but I'm like, I'm going to do the thing that I haven't done in all these other years before. I'm going to devote myself 100% to it, and no excuses. And I did. And I remember it was so funny because, like, the first real checks came in at about the 18-month mark. That was like, you get to the 1 year mark and you're like, man, I haven't made a penny. You know what I mean? Like, nothing's panned out.
So this wasn't easy, though. Like, this, you had some moments where it's like, this is awful. What am I doing?
Yeah, that was most of the time. Honestly, my first couple of experiences were so bad that I immediately kind of found myself going like, what am I trying to get into? You know what I mean? Like, I've been in some good TV rooms, but I've also been in some pretty bad TV rooms. And bad is, like, different for every person, but it's weird to be in an environment sometimes where it feels like you're not wanted. you know, and you are made very, very unwelcome. And people say will say some pretty nasty things about you, and it'll get into your psyche. You'll start believing it. So it was pretty hard to kind of push through a lot of that stuff. But thankfully I did. You know, I was like, all right, I'm going to give it to 2 years. You know, keep on pushing, and it worked out.
What's so fly about what you said is that you go from rooms to not being wanted, and then to a room where you're the first Black co-creator of a Disney Pixar, and it's like not even wanted to, like, I'm the only one that's doing this. Like, what was that process like for you? And when I say co-director, I don't even know if there's been a direct sole director, just like one.
No, apparently I'm the first of any.
Bro, dog, I just want to applaud you for that, dog. I didn't think that we would be seeing first in 2021 like this. And we're seeing that, a lot.
And that's just, it's like, I don't know if applause is really necessary because it's, you know.
I'm giving you your flowers, though, Kemp. I am giving them to you, man.
It's unfortunate then, you know, in 100 years of Disney feature animation that no one else who's looked like me has ever been in the director or co-director's chair. That's, again, it's not, I appreciate it, but, you know, my attitude is like, okay, how quickly can we get the second and the third and the fourth?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
There's a lot of catching up to do. I'm so happy that Soul was received as positively as it was by audiences and critically, of course, because, you know, if it hadn't been, God knows how long it would have taken for the second. But I think that we proved a positive here, and I hope that Hollywood is willing to accept the positive that we proved, that culturally specific elements stories can find a wide audience, you know, can appeal to people outside of the group that's being represented on screen, particularly as it pertains to animation. You know, some of the data that most excited me about Soul was finding out that Soul was like the second biggest Pixar movie in history in China, or like the biggest Pixar movie in history in Russia. Mm. And those are environments where you don't expect films with predominantly black cast to necessarily travel, as, you know, the Hollywood wisdom would say. So to see Soul's success, not just here at home, but specifically abroad in markets where that wouldn't have been expected, that makes me really, really happy. I mean, I wasn't surprised because the biggest Pixar hit of all time in China, number one, is Coco. Yeah. You know,
so yeah, I'm not surprised. I'm excited to hear them, though. But like, we know what the black film can do. We know a quote unquote black film can do. You know what I'm saying? We've seen that dollar, what our dollar can do.
I didn't know I was first when I was there. Like, until I didn't even realize it until we were pretty much about to kind of like wrap up the film and they started working on promoting it. And that kind of, that's when that narrative started appearing. And I was like, well, that can't be right, can it? You know what I mean? Like, I was like, no, that can't be right. And it was like, oh, wow, it is? Yeah, it kind of caught me off guard.
This is a two-part question. I want to know, like, because I know my daughter, man, she does, when she see me on TV, it's like, oh, okay, that's cool, that's daddy. But your kids kind of get what a Pixar movie is. Like, what does that feel like to them? And also, and this is not related to the kids, but please answer that one first. And I got the next one.
Well, I mean, it's weird for me because, you know, my kids are a little older. I mean, my son is 17 and my daughter's 22, and they've kind of been around and seen me go through this process for years now. So I don't know. I mean, if they're in awe of anything, they hide it really well.
Really? I would have been like, my pop, I would have had pictures.
No, dude. I mean, I don't know. Maybe my kids are just like low, super duper low key, but like, they don't seem to be very phased, you know? Like, it's kind of like, it's just what their dad does.
You super chill like that too, though. Like,
yeah. And I guess maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's because I'm the way that I am. You know what I'm saying? Then they're kind of the way that they are. I mean, it was funny because I remember when we announced Soul at Disney's D23, you know, we had to go out to D23 and they have all the big Disney movies, all the cast backstage. And I brought my kids, of course. And, you know, at the time, you know, my son's a huge, huge fan of Hamilton. So, you know, I knew David was going to be there because of us announcing Soul. And I was like, hey, I introduced him to David Diggs. And he was like, oh, cool. I was like, so are you excited you met David Diggs? He's like, oh, yeah, he was cool. And I'm just going like, man, like, you know, we're in a room. Yeah. And it's like, there's the cast of Star Wars. You know what I mean? There's The Rock. You know what I mean? Yeah. Here's our cast. There's Jamie and Felicia Rashad and Tina Fey. And they're like, oh, yeah, everyone's really cool. Everyone's nice. And I'm like, all right, I guess this is just normal for y'all.
I love it, man. I geeked out because I think I geeked out on the dude that did Free Solo at D23 one time. Like, I started screaming because I had just, like, watched him climb this mountain. And so I was just, like, going crazy. The second part of that Soul question, man, is, like, how... Please talk me to me about this process of the afterlife, like the two-dimensional use of that, and just how you guys came up with this concept and how you directed within that part of just what the afterlife looked like, because it was very different from Coco, you know what I'm saying, where that place looked like. But I was right. So intrigued by the way these shapes move, the use of the shapes, all of that stuff, man. And I think that was I'm sure it was a draw for a lot of people.
First, there was no one person responsible for any idea. It was really a collaborative process. And in terms of the look of the film, I mean, and particularly as it pertains to The Great Before, a lot of that stuff, man, ideas came from everywhere. I mean, just like the counselors, the line drawings that we ended up using as the counselors, that was an idea of one of our story artists, Afton Corbin. You know, the wonderful thing about being at Pixar is that good ideas can come from anywhere. And you're encouraged, if you have a good idea, share it with the creative team.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So whether it's coming from the designers or the story artists or the animators, everyone's really encouraged to tell the directors ideas that they have when they come to them. And you'd be amazed how much of it can actually find its way into the film. I mean, a lot of being a director, in particular for animation, kind of feels like air traffic control. You know, you have a team of over 400 people, you know, working for years in all these different departments, and they're kind of working, it's very compartmentalized, where you take for granted as a director because you have this view of all of it and you understand how it works together. The people working on it, though, in their individual departments often don't, you know, and they have no idea how what they're doing is going to fit into this other thing. So it's kind of really up to us to connect the pieces of the puzzle. And The Great Before, I mean, in making the film, we finished Soul, well, I should say we animated it out of sequence order. All animated films are animated out of sequence order. But most of the stuff in The Great Before, the Soul-related stuff, that was the last stuff to be animated. We animated almost all the human world stuff first. A lot of it was because we hadn't finalized designs. You know, even after the story was set and we were recording the voice artist, we still were kind of tweaking things like the look of it, because we had to try a lot of stuff that didn't work before we finally landed on things that did work.
How did you transition into, and maybe you've been doing this all of your career and I just didn't know it, but into director? Because I know you primarily as a writer, and to see that directing on your credit was like, dang, it makes sense, because we're all artists and I understand that we could do everything. But I know that's hard to transverse in Hollywood. How did you do that?
Well, I mean, I credit a lot of that to Pete Docter, the head of Pixar and the creative head of Pixar and the director. And that in many ways, my first directing job was very much almost like it was like my directing gig was also an apprenticeship. I really kind of learned by being alongside Pete and seeing what he was doing. It was like learning through osmosis. That's what inspired him to make me his co-director, because, you know, I had a job to do. I was hired as a writer and I was doing my writing job. But when I wasn't writing, I was like out in different departments, just talking to people, figuring out what they did. You know, it was just my natural curiosity. So it got to a certain point where I started really contributing to the film in a lot of ways outside of writing. And I think just the producers and Pete took note of that. And that's why he asked me to come on board and be co-director. I mean, the first question that I had when he asked me was like, what does that mean? And he said, well, you've kind of already been doing it. You know, like I took for granted that I was in all the meetings that he was in, that I was in edit. I mean, a lot of films are largely, they're made in edit, you know, and I didn't realize writers often weren't in editorial because I was spending so much time in editorial, you know, from the get-go, you know, and in dailies and in all the different elements. So really, you know, I kind of learned to be a director from Pete.
Shout out to him for understanding the need to have you there.
Yeah, that was just it. He said to me, he was like, I can't finish this film without you. And that's quite a thing for someone, especially someone like him. He was a man with multiple Academy Awards. He's responsible for Monsters, Inc., Up, Inside Out. He wrote WALL-E. You know, he's one of the writers of Toy Story. You know, this idea that he felt that my voice was necessary to do this film right was really something, because a lot of people, I think, in his position wouldn't have thought that way. Mm. It was quite a leap of faith on his part. And I'm glad it worked out well for all of us.
How did you hone your voice? If you had to describe it, what is your voice? I know you're a storyteller. Where does that come from, though?
All my voice is a collection of all the experiences I've had in my life, good and bad. You know what I mean? Like, that's who I am. I can't go back and change anything. I can't change the bad things. I can't change the good things. But it's all of those things collectively that make me who I am and the type of person that I am and the types of things that I'm interested in. And one thing I've always had a pretty strong sense of is like myself. Like, I know who I am. I know what I'm into. And I'm not ashamed of any of those things. A lot of my friends, they laugh because I'm known as, like, notoriously as not being a joiner. Like, I don't join groups very often. You know, I'm not a... And a lot of that comes from being young and not being welcome anywhere.
Well, like Facebook groups or what?
No, like organizations or clubs.
Oh, okay.
When I was young, I was so not welcome so many places. That kind of became this thing where it was like, I got tired of asking people if I could be in their clubs. Mm. And so I just started doing things on my own. Like you said, it's like, that's, I guess, why I'm perceived as just so chill, because I just kind of like, okay, the job is done. What's next? And it's like, oh, okay, here's something else cool. Now I'm going to start doing that. I just kind of move on to the next thing. My head never really gets gassed up that much because, again, I have a very strong sense of who I am because of things like that. I remember vividly, like freshman year college, wanting badly to join a fraternity. I remember approaching one of the dudes in the frat that I wanted to join, and he made it like pretty clear that he was going to make it pretty much impossible for me to get into the frat. You know, he didn't want me in it.
Yeah,
I didn't know the dude that well. I hadn't done anything to him. He just didn't like the sound of my voice. You know what I mean? Like, dude was like from Atlanta, and I was from New York, and that was it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? So he just didn't like the sound of my voice. I was like, kind of like, yo, man, I was like, fuck you and this frat.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not gonna, you know what I mean? It's like, and it was like that kind of shit had been happening to me like my whole life, where it's just like, wow, y'all are doing some cool stuff. Can I join? No.
Hey, they will have you as an honorary member now. I bet you, bro.
But I'm saying, like, that's how it's always been. And I'm talking like writing groups. You know what I mean? Like, there'd be like a writing group. And I'd be like, oh, wow, I'm a writer. I'd love to be in your writing group. There's no more room.
Seats taken.
I'm due. I remember like after One Night in Miami came out, just like applying to be sending in my stuff to just be like in playwriting groups around LA and everyone telling me no.
Wow.
You know, I've flown solo, you know, like my friends are my friends, my people are my people. But creatively, I've always just flown solo for so long that it's just kind of like, now I'm just happy kind of like being solo, you know, and doing what I do.
What table did you sit at in high school? Like when lunchtime came, what table were you at? Were you like at the long, I'm assuming you were like, yo, I'm out of here. I'm going to the library or something like that.
Actually, no, it was two tables because keep in mind, I'm from New York, but I finished high school my last 2 years. I finished high school in Virginia.
Okay.
So,
what part?
Hampton.
Okay.
Newport News. I was in Newport News, Virginia at Warwick High. So the table that I would have been at in New York was very, very different than the table I was at in Virginia. You see what I'm saying? So
no, I can imagine.
In New York, the table I was at was actually kind of like the arty kids table. You know what I mean? It was like a lot of kids. I would say like everyone played Dungeons and Dragons at my table. You know what I mean? Like everyone was playing Dungeons and Dragons. Some kids were like in the theater program. Almost everyone was planning to go to like CUNY or, you know, Brooklyn College. Everyone was like hardcore locals, but it was definitely kind of like a Dungeons and Dragons artsy kind of table. In Virginia, my table would have been the troublemakers table. And I'm talking like,
I thought that would have been reversed, actually.
Nah. In New York, I was like honor student, like never any trouble. But when I went to Virginia, I was really, I didn't want to be there. And the teachers didn't want me there. And I kind of acted out. And by like, you know, I definitely hung around with a different group of kids. And most of my friends in Virginia, it would have been the knucklehead table. I'm not saying that some of them dealt drugs, but I'm not saying they didn't deal drugs. Let's put it that way. You know what I'm saying? No, like,
I don't know what my homies was doing, but I know they was doing something.
The South is also real different. True that. That's another thing, is that I was at a school in Virginia that was like 86-87% Black, you know, which was very different than my school in New York. And in New York, I was at Edward R. Murrow High School, where I think it's like, can't be more than like 12 or 13% Black students. Very artsy. It's a school that Jean-Michel Basquiat went to, Marissa Tomei, Darren Aronofsky. They all went to my high school in New York. In Virginia, my high school, Warwick, that's the school that Michael Vick went to.
Right.
When I say it's 87% Black, I was in all honors classes, and I was often the only Black kid in the honors classes at this overwhelmingly Black school. So I got to see how race was so different down South. You know what I mean? All of a sudden, it was just Black and white kids. In New York, there was Puerto Rican kids, Chinese kids. Virginia, it was like Black and white. And even though it was almost all Black kids at the school, all the good stuff was like the white kids. Like all the good clubs. So I was kind of pissed, you know, a lot of the time that I was there because, yeah, I hung out with my friends. I took Taekwondo. So it was one of those things where it was like fighting was like a good release for me in those years. But I totally was like at the knucklehead table for high school.
Transitioning to one night in Miami. I'm guessing that this was maybe in COVID or right before COVID started to happen, or did it come out during COVID?
No. We finished principal photography in New Orleans about a week before everything shut down.
Okay.
But we weren't done with the movie. We finished the movie during COVID. In fact, One Night in Miami was one of the first big productions to get a permit to shoot there, a COVID-safe shoot, because we had two more days that we had to shoot here in Long Beach and in L.A. And it was tense because it was so much more expensive to shoot COVID safe, especially the beginning.
Yeah.
And we only had like, it was like, if we don't get this in 2 days, we had already been accepted into some film festivals. And it was like, if we don't get this now, there's no way we could finish the movie this year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, God bless Regina, because she was really committed to like trying to get this movie done, like now in time to get into Venice and to get into Toronto. And I think those two film festivals in particular really, really kind of launched us into the collective consciousness, because it was really, really well received in both places, in both festivals.
Two-part question. What was the adaptation like? Because I know that this was a play first for you to get it to a screenplay. And what was the process like of like, does this thing just get handed to Regina and she says, oh, I want to do this? Or was there like, did it get handed to a few people and you were like, yo, Regina's about to, she's about to kill this? Because, bro, it was beautifully done.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, honestly, it was, I worked on the script first. So I had to adapt the play first before it went out to any directors. And I had been adapting the play for about a year through various drafts till it finally got to a place where the producers were like, all right, let's send it out and let's try and get a director. Regina, to my knowledge, was the first director who got a hold of it.
Stop it. She saw it and was like, boom, this is what I want to do. That don't happen.
No, she got it. It was like, I think she had just changed agencies specifically because she was looking for a feature film to direct. She was definitely the first person to get a hold of it. And I think it might have been the first script her new agent gave her. So she read it. And she was shooting Watchmen at the time and she wanted to meet me. So I was up in the Bay working on Soul and we just did a FaceTime call. You know, she was in Atlanta. I was here in California and we just had like a 2-hour conversation about the script. She just really dug it and was like, yeah, I really think this is like what I want to do. And I was like, wow, that would be amazing. And this is all before she won the Oscar.
Yeah.
You know? So that all happened. And I was like, well, this is great. Regina's going to direct it. It's going to be awesome. I'm sure she'll do a good job. because she got nominated for the Oscar. And I was like, oh, wow. If Regina wins the Oscar, I think we might have to find a new director. Because, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, when you do stuff like that, a lot of Hollywood comes banging on your door. And she deserved to win, and she did win. But I was like, okay, let's see what she wants to do. But a couple of weeks after the Oscars, she reached out and was like, okay, let's close this deal. The next thing I'm doing is directing One Night in Miami before I do any more movies. And that's what she did. As soon as she finished Watchmen, she did One Night in Miami, and she put everything else on hold.
Dude, one of the most powerful scenes, people talk about this in articles and stuff. I really enjoyed that scene with Malcolm and Jim. But one of the ones that was really powerful for me was, and I was like, I wanted to ask you this because I was like, this had to be, I'm sure he added this, but it was where Muhammad Ali and Sam Cooke were talking in a car. And the fact that they were in that car, though, with the lights and everything, because I was like, he wouldn't have been able to do this in a play, is what's the thing that I was thinking. And I was like, but the fact that they're able to do this here, it was so beautiful and just like, dope to have that conversation, man. How did you do that? How did you come to wanted to add that?
Well, I mean, the wonderful thing about the play is very much meant to be a play, and it exists and it works as a play. It's real time. It begins when these men enter the room, and it ends an hour and a half later when they leave. For the film, it's a wonderful opportunity to expand the world. And expanding the world doesn't just mean shooting lots of other scenes. It's expanding the world and expanding the characters by allowing interactions that I couldn't do in the stage play. So much of the stage play is people coming in and out of the room. Even though it's the four of them, a lot of the times in the stage play, they're in sets of two because people come and go. Mm. And with the film, the wonderful thing we have the opportunity to do is leave the room when people leave the room to see what's happening with the person who's left the room. And we did that all throughout. Malcolm X being in the phone booth, talking to his daughter. In the play, he just leaves the room and says, I'll be right back. And we stay there with the guys. In the film, we're able to go with Malcolm, see him make the call, see him interact with his daughter, his wife. None of that's in the play.
And you had to imagine these things, yeah? Like, oh, yes, what would he be doing? Like the rooftop, that was beautiful,
yeah,
too.
The conversation they have on the rooftop is in the play, but it doesn't happen. It happens in the room. With the film, no matter how good or bad the writing is, the reality is it starts feeling claustrophobic. And it was important to kind of treat the entire hotel the way we treated the room in the play.
Yes.
So in the play, it's all set in one room. In the film, it was important to see the room, so to speak, as the entire Hampton House Hotel and really use it all. That includes the parking lot, the diner, the roof, the pool. See what I'm saying?
Like, and you moved organically to these places too. Like,
yeah.
It wasn't done out of force. It was like, oh no, we got to go up there. Let's get some more. Let's get quiet. I need to get away from these people.
Yeah.
It was so nice, bro.
It was really cool. Like the special effects folks, they did such a good job. People don't realize it's special effects, but like the fireworks on the roof, those are all effects.
Oh no, I didn't know. I didn't.
Yeah, that's all SFX. So, I mean, there's so many things in all those moments where it's like, special effects just really like bring you into the moment in a really, really cool way.
That was fly. Just a few more questions, man. Then we're going to get into this freestyle. Hope you're ready for this. Just walk me through what it was like Oscar night, man. Did you expect it? Were you excited? I'm sure you were.
I was excited, but I was also kind of just like so relieved that it was finally done. You know what I mean? Like I've been doing so many interviews and it was really cool that people were excited, but there's a certain amount of it where you're answering the same questions over and over and over and over again. And it's cool. I just love that people are so interested in your work. But honestly, by Oscar night itself, we've been promoting those movies for 6 months, you know? So I was like, okay, this is great. I just treated it as what it really was, which was just like a party to celebrate, honestly, all the movies that came out that year. Because, you know, that's the thing. When you're on the awards circuit, and you're doing all these interviews, you start making friends with other people. You know what I mean? And it was really cool to really sit down and have conversations with everyone from like the Lucas brothers and Shaka King to like, you know, Lee Isaac, who did Minari, to Ramin, who did The White Tiger. Like, it was really cool just like connecting and really feeling a sense of community. It's so funny. The irony, as I said earlier, I don't ever join clubs or anything like that. I finally kind of felt like I was part of a community.
That's fly.
And it was a community of people who who got their movies made that year, it felt like we were all kind of being celebrated together.
That's
so wild. That element of it was actually really kind of sweet and really, really nice. And because the films came out streaming and we'd never seen them in movie theaters, honestly, the Oscars was the first event I'd gone to like the whole time. Mm. There was never an in-person opening night for either movie. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it was all happening streaming or at home, you know, virtual premieres. That was the first time I was like out with folks. It was very cool and chill and just nice to finally be out in the world again after spending damn near a year locked down in our houses.
I feel you. All right, man, I'm gonna let you go. We're gonna do this flow. I'm gonna freestyle a little bit, then I'm gonna pass the mic to you. If you got some, you can say a joke if you want to, man. That's gonna be it. We got a freestyle, so I'm gonna play a beat. I wrote some because I was like, I ain't about to mess up with Kemp on here. So I got some written. And if you feel it,
I don't have anything written, and you're gonna.
I had to, dog. I was like, I ain't about to mess up. I gotta bring you in, fly. All right, I'm gonna play the beat, and then just let it use you, man. The Blue Mini. Yo, I'm in the Blue Mini, and I'm with my homie Kemp. We up in the motherfucker, eating lobster and shrimp. Let me know that you know we going for that goal. And when I say go, that's the Oscar. My boy got sold. Oh, yeah. We in the thing. Give it to Kemp, man. Do your thing, man.
Some people say that I got a little soul. Some people say that I like to rock and roll. In reality, I do them both.
Yo, I rocks with it, dog. I rocks with it. I'm going to put it together, dog. Kemp, man, I appreciate you, man.
Of course. Yeah, good stuff.
Thank you. Y'all travel safe, man.
Thank you very much, man. It's good to see you again.
You too, man. Continue to enjoy the rise, homie.
Yeah, let's catch up in person, too, when we have a chance.
All right, I would love that. All right, man. Thank you, man.
Peace.